It's Dear Instructional Designer, episode 19. Hey everybody, welcome back to Dear Instructional Designer, the show about the instructional design journey. I'm your host, Kristen Anthony. Today I'm talking with Aunt Pew, e-learning business owner from across the pond. One of our previous guests, Alyssa Gomez, actually reached out to me with rave reviews about Aunt's new free subscription learning course on getting the most out of e-learning for a business. So I reached out to him and asked him to discuss how he is building his successful e-learning business and the hows and whys of building this free course. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Aunt.
All right. So, Aunt, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show.
It's my pleasure. Nice to speak to you, Kristen.
So, to begin with here, why don't you tell me a little bit about how you became an instructional designer?
Okay, cool. Well, I don't know if this is going to interrupt the flow of your podcast season, but I don't really class myself as an instructional designer per se.
Okay.
I think I've kind of been an instructional designer, not necessarily by design, but I kind of fell into that. And I think I've come out the other side a little while ago. So I see myself now more as an e-learning consultant than an LMS, than an instructional designer. So just to kind of give you a background, I graduated university degree in design, computer-aided design, back sort of 12, 13 years ago. But I never really wanted to sort of have a job where I sat in front of a computer. I was always quite, a people person and enjoyed interacting with people. And I felt that doing computer-aided design, I'd just be kind of stuck in front of a computer 5 days a week. So that led me straight into a job as a trainer. And I was doing a lot of software training. I did a variety of different jobs as a trainer, different sort of types of software for different audiences. And I did that for about 5 or 6 years. And then I kind of moved into a sort of more of a training manager role where I would manage teams of trainers and training programs. And I kind of felt like I'd reached the ceiling in that as well after a few years of doing that. And I was quite sort of ambitious and keen to progress in my career. And that's when I kind of came into e-learning and I realized that sort of my passions for design and the things that I'd been doing at university and my eye for design, I could really use that alongside my skills and experiences as a trainer. I could then use that to start building e-learning. So I did a couple of different roles. I did a bit of freelancing as a sort of independent e-learning designer. I then took a kind of more corporate type role working for a big telecommunications company as their e-learning designer. And that quite quickly progressed into kind of an e-learning management role where I was responsible for not just creating content, but actually thinking about the strategy for the company as a whole, how that company was going to roll out e-learning to its employees and to its partners. And I did that for a number of years. And I really enjoyed that because it wasn't just a case of going into the individual courses themselves and actually figuring out how I could make an interaction work or how I could provide some teaching, some learning through, an activity or an e-learning interaction. It was more about the bigger picture of how the whole program would work and who would have access to it and ensuring people were engaging with the program as a whole. So it was a bit more of a step back and a bit more of a strategic role. And then when I kind of left that role about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I set up my own business, my own consultancy. And I started off building content because that's what I knew best. And that's where I'd been doing for the last few years. But quite quickly realized that my passion was really more to do with the e-learning strategy and helping companies with their overall learning and development strategy. So I do a lot of e-learning design, but I'm kind of slowly transitioning across to a more of a consulting role where I help businesses with their overall e-learning strategy, I guess. So probably a bit of a long-winded way of saying answering your question, but kind of got there in a roundabout way.
Yeah, no problem. That was great. But so, and I, what you were describing sounds like instructional design to me. How do you see the difference between an instructional designer and an e-learning designer? Like, is it just the way you pitch yourself?
Well, yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think I'm still learning about the differences. I mean, I think 18 months ago, I definitely did call myself an instructional designer. And I always thought that the instructional design role was a case of building interactive or building e-learning experiences or online training experiences. And that would be right you know, through the whole process from going through the training needs analysis to doing the sort of development to actually building the content itself and then actually launching it and evaluating the success. But I'm not sure whether this is a difference between how we phrase things over here in the UK as to whether it's different to the US and Canada. But I've started to see the terminology change slightly, where the term instructional designer for me is now more geared towards the person who takes the content and converts that into a storyboard ready to be built into e-learning. I don't know what you, is that a similar, would that be a similar description to how you'd explain instructional designer?
Certainly some people can have a role that looks like that, but I would say a lot of the roles that you see with this term instructional designer for a lot of people are it's going from beginning, the kickoff, all the way to the end. So the instructional designer wears all the hats in many, many organizations.
Okay, well, that's interesting. And I think that differs for example, if you look on a lot of job sites, you see adverts for instructional designers, and a lot of people are looking for somebody who can do the whole end-to-end process. In fact, I wrote a blog article quite recently about how kind of frustrated me to see a job advert where somebody was pitching for an instructional designer / trainer, because not only is that somebody who is going to build end-to-end online learning solutions, but they're also going to have the skill of actually delivering classroom training as well. And it's a very different, to me, that those are two very different jobs. So I think it's sometimes people don't understand the detail of what an instructional designer does. But then on the other end of the spectrum, I'm seeing job advert, you know, people advertising for an instructional designer, and actually all they want is somebody to take the raw content and convert that into a storyboard format. And then they'll pass that on to a development team, and that might be outsourced, you know, in a different country or, you know, externally to their company. And they'll actually build that content from that storyboard. And the instructional design, the learning design, it's all in the storyboard. It's all in that researching the TNA and the actual making sure that the content is being, created in the right way. But actually the development side, that can almost be outsourced to somebody who has no instructional design skills, because they're, you know, basically just looking at a storyboard and making that look pretty, essentially making it work. So yeah, I think it's interesting to hear the different ways that we could use the term instructional designer, I think.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think that you've pointed out a lot of great things for our listeners to sort of be on the lookout for. You know, what exactly is it that you want to be able to do in your work? And yeah, just all instructional design positions are not created equal. So that's really good insight. So, Ant, what would you say are some of the skills that you've developed over your years? You know, you've had all of these different jobs and you have really created a trajectory for yourself. What would you say are some of the skills that you've developed to help you do your job better?
I think the key skill that really popped out in my head as soon as you asked that question was my ability to take complex information and deliver that in a way that people can understand. And I go right back to when I started work as a trainer. And I think this is where I first learned that skill. I'm not for one second saying you need to be a trainer before you can become an instructional designer, because I've met a lot of people who are even better at this than me, who probably haven't been a trainer. But one of my roles as a trainer was to actually train sort of the elder generation. I was working on board a cruise ship, and we set up a small business that would teach sort of the older demographic who are on these cruise holidays to use technology. So they'd be on their cruise holiday. And I don't know if have you ever been on a cruise, Kristen?
Yeah.
Okay. Was it a week or 2 weeks or?
It was a week.
Okay. And I'm sure on that cruise, you had a few days where you'd be stopping in different ports and then a few days where you'd just be sailing. Yeah.
Yep.
Cool. So that's exactly how the cruise holidays that I was experiencing worked. And all the days where the passengers were in port, they were able to go off and see the sights and go and explore the ports and the different towns, you know, all the different places that you're stopping on the ship. But then there were these long sea days where they'd have nothing to do. So we actually set up these technology-based workshops, essentially, where the passengers would come along, groups of sort of 15, 20, 25 people, and we do little workshops teaching them how to do things, really simple things, things that you and me probably almost laugh at, but things like how to send an email, how to transfer your photos from your digital camera onto your computer, how to sell an item on eBay, how to post a photo to Facebook, how to set up your family tree, one of the family on one of the genealogy websites, all the sort of simple stuff that we take for granted that maybe the older generation don't feel comfortable doing. And having a couple of hours with them in a sort of relaxed environment where they, you know, they didn't have the pressures of everyday life and they could really focus on what somebody was saying proved to be a really good, you know, environment to teach people these tools. And I actually remember the first time I actually went to do that job, I kind of said to everyone, right, everyone switch your computers on and let's open Photoshop. This was a kind of a digital photo editing class that we were going to show them how to remove red eye from photos. And I remember one of the first chaps I spoke to, I said, you know, okay, move your mouse and open Photoshop. And he kind of looked at me very blankly. He was quite an elderly gentleman. And I said, and he sort of looked at me blankly and I said, you know, move your mouse on the screen. And he actually picked up his mouse and held it against the monitor of the computer and started moving his mouse around, almost like he was trying to remote control, you know, like you would with your TV. You'd point your mouse at your remote control at your TV and press the button to turn the volume up. He was doing this with his mouse, trying to move the arrow around. And I mean, this was sort of 10, 15 years ago. So it was about 10 years ago, actually. So I'm sure there's not many people who still have that kind of understanding of technology. But what it made me realize was that I had to really rethink how I was teaching people. And just by saying, move your mouse into the corner and open Photoshop, that didn't mean a lot to somebody who'd never used a computer before. So it made me look at my teaching skills and made me take a step back and think, right, how do I break this down so he can actually follow through this workshop, you know, without being left behind? And most of these people actually didn't have very good computer skills. And I think after doing this course, we decided that we actually needed an even more basic course. I think we called it Computers for the Terrified. And it really was, you know, how do you switch a computer on? How do you log in? How do you, you know, move the mouse around and that kind of stuff? And yeah, so I've really taken that skill into my career, and I think it's something that I think a lot of us as a society, we forget that expertise that we've developed either in our jobs or in our personal lives, in whatever we do, in hobbies and activities, and in especially in our day-to-day work, we become so skilled and so knowledgeable about the minute detail that we work on. We forget that people who aren't involved in that don't understand. So, you know, especially talking about e-learning, and we're talking about taking the subject matters experts and converting that into material that somebody else can understand. I think that's been something that's really helped me, because I've been able to understand that this subject matter expert, he's got this 200-page PowerPoint presentation, and he's got, you know, everything in individual minute detail. And actually, half of this information is probably irrelevant to most people who are sitting there and taking the course. So it's going to be a case of me pulling out the key important information and working with that subject matter expert to make sure that, you know, that the person who's going to be learning from this is getting value from it and isn't just not going to go straight over their head. So, I'd say that was the sort of key skill that I've acquired and been able to use in my career.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, I mean, you talked about, and I absolutely agree with you, this whole idea of being able to sort of be a translator and get out of that expert blind spot. And so my next question would be, would you say that was sort of your biggest challenge working with subject matter experts? And I guess another follow-up would be, you know, do you get pushback if you say, well, we're going to cut this bit because that's really your expertise speaking?
Yeah, I had a really good conversation about this with the group of guys that I'm in a community with yesterday, and I'll give them a shout out, actually. I think you've spoken to some guys on your podcast before who are part of this community, but it's the Online Network of Independent Learning Professionals. We're just a group. We're between about 50 and 100 independent e-learning freelancers or contractors or consultants. Interesting to discuss the difference between those phrases. But yeah, basically people who are not working for big companies, who are starting their own businesses, their own small agencies, or they're just working as solopreneurs, essentially. And we've all got together and set up a community to help each other out. We meet once a week on Thursdays online, and we just do a little presentation. Somebody out of the community does a presentation for 15, 20 minutes on something that they're very skilled in. Everybody else can sort of jump in with questions and answers. And we have
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's cool. And we have an online Slack community that we use in between sessions. So we have this ongoing dialogue in between calls where if you've got a question about, you know, whether it's anything to do with my client hasn't paid me, or I'm not sure how to write this proposal, or is this conference any good, or which book are you reading at the moment? All that kind of stuff. It's really, really useful. So it's been an amazing resource. So if anybody's interested in joining, you know, definitely give me a shout and we'll hook you up. But yeah, massive tangent there. So sorry about that. But my point was, we were in one of our discussions yesterday, and we were talking about SMEs and having this kind of pushback from experts, essentially, and how we as independent freelancers or consultants or indeed structural designers, how do we deal with that pushback? And I think for me, and I think this was the sort of point that came out of that conversation yesterday, was that it's all down to how we position ourselves in that relationship. And we need to position ourselves at the very beginning of that relationship with that subject matter expert as an expert in learning design. And you've got to be quite assertive, I think, to do that. And I'm not talking about being kind of, you know, arrogant or rude, but it's a case of when you have those initial kickoff meetings and you're talking to the subject matter expert, sometimes the subject matter expert is also the client or the key decision maker, the person who's going to be paying for this course to be created. So obviously we have to be tactful, but going into that first conversation, it's important to be assertive and to say, you know, look, this is my expertise. I know nothing about rocket science. I know nothing about whatever it is that you're coming to me to build a course about. I use the phrase rocket science because I worked for a satellite telecommunications company and we actually had rocket scientists working in the office. So it was one of those phrases we threw around quite a lot. It's not rocket science. And it was, well, actually, it is in this case, it is rocket science. But yeah, just being assertive and having that conversation up front and say, look, I know nothing about rocket science. You're the expert. And that's why I need you. And you're going to be guiding what goes into this content. But I understand how people learn. I understand the amount of information people can consume in any given experience, whether that's a 5 to 10 minute animation or a 20 minute interactive module or a series, you know, if we're building a much bigger course of a series of modules. I understand how we're going to break this content down, how we can make it flow, how we can create each interaction so that we're really focusing on the key learning points across that module and ensuring that they understand that at the beginning and really defining those roles right up front. And then you're setting expectations. And then 3 months down the line, there are no nasty surprises when they get some pushback on something. And you can go straight back to that conversation you had at the beginning and say, look, you know, remember we had this conversation. This is my expertise. I'm very grateful for this information you're providing. However, I recommend that we do it in this way. And then I guess it's a case of after that, if they push back to the point where they demand that this goes in the way that they're doing it, it's up to us as instructional designers, whether we make a decision to say, look, my reputation's on the line here. I'm not willing to build this course in this way. I've never seen it come to that, actually. I think, you know, you can obviously come to a compromise, but it may be sometimes I've seen it happen where, you know, some clients come to me and said, I want this course being built. I want this in this color. I want it to look like this. It's got to have these characters. It's got to have this. You know, they've almost done it themselves. It's like, well, you don't really need an instructional designer. If you're not harnessing my expertise as an instructional designer here, you just want somebody who can build your course for you. You know, you might as well go onto one of these websites like Upwork and find somebody who's, you know, $10 an hour to build exactly what you want them to build. But if you want to harness my expertise as a learning designer, I would recommend that we do it in this way. So I hope that answered your question in a roundabout way.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we've had a few entrepreneurs on the podcast at this point, and it's always interesting to hear about how you guys handle that sort of situation. And I think it's really useful for everybody because we have to deal with that, you know, even if you're not a freelancer or a solopreneur, these are issues that we all have to deal with. So it's really useful, I think, to get all of these different perspectives on how to best do that.
It's definitely something I'm still learning, and I'm definitely not the finished product when it comes to dealing with these situations, you know. And, you know, especially if you're running a business, it's difficult to sometimes make that decision, you know, when you're starting out and you haven't got a lot of work coming in. Somebody wants you to build the course that they want. It's very difficult to say no, because, you know, if you say it almost comes down to that situation where if somebody comes to you and says, look, I want to build an e-learning course to do X, Y, and Z, and you actually look at it and you think, well, by building this course, we're not going to achieve X, Y, and Z, then we have to make a difficult decision. Is it actually a better solution for the company not to spend thousands of pounds on me as an e-learning designer or instructional designer to build this course? Because an email to employees would do the same job and it cost you next to nothing. That will do me out of the project. You know, I'm not going to get paid to do this project, but it's going to solve the business solution better. And it's a tough decision then. What do we do? As professionals, you know, I think the word client in Latin means, you know, you're protecting somebody. Don't quote me on that. But I think the word client has something to do with protection anyway. So the concept is, as our client, we're supposed to be protecting them and looking after them. And, you know, maybe in the short term, if we were to turn around and say, look, you don't need to create an e-learning course for this. You can simply send them an email and it's going to provide the same amount of value. You're going to do yourself out of a project in the first place. But in the long term, you would like to think, and, you know, I'm not sure if this is true, but I would hope Karna would come back to say, okay, you know, this guy was honest and upfront about this project. But now we've got a much bigger project 6 months later. He's the guy we're going to go to because we trust him implicitly. And he protected us last time and had our interest in heart. So it's difficult, though, especially when you're starting out and you're taking any work that you can get. And then I did exactly the same. You know, I've made all the mistakes you can in the book. So it's tough when you're starting out.
Yeah, absolutely. So what would you say, just sort of broadly, and I know that you have, I think, 5 bullet points on your website. Not bullet points, but five points in your process. But what would you say is your model for sort of a kickoff and a collaboration, and why does that work for you?
Okay, so I use a process called road mapping now, and I started doing this about a year ago because I was finding that I was writing a lot of proposals for clients, or, you know, having lots of in-depth conversation with clients who had an idea for either an e-learning course or an e-learning project or a program, or maybe I'm speaking to more and more companies who are looking to maybe migrate to a new LMS, or they don't currently have an LMS and they're looking to pick an LMS and to create that and to introduce that into their organization. And what I find is that I need to do a lot of background work to correctly provide them with a detailed proposal with a realistic estimate of how much that's going to cost. You know, whether it's a 2-minute video scribe animation or whether it's an e-learning platform that's going to be available to hundreds of thousands of people, a 10-minute phone call isn't going to be enough information for me to make a decision on what that client is going to need or what that person is going to need from me. So what I do is I organize a road mapping session, which can be anything from 1 hour to a couple of days. Usually it takes about half a day, and I'll either sit down with that person in the room, or I've done most of my road mapping sessions virtually. Actually, I use video conferencing software. I use Zoom, actually. I'm finding that's a really good tool at the moment. And yeah, we just do a face-to-face conversation. We really get down to the nitty-gritty of what that client is looking to achieve. And I think the key here is it goes back to the last comment, actually, about going to these people and going to these clients as an expert, and rather than just sitting there and listening to their self-diagnosis of, I need an e-learning course for X, Y, and Z. I've heard the analogy used before of going to the doctor's surgery. You would never go to the doctors and say, I've got a pain in my chest. Can you give me this type of drug and do this type of operation on me? You would go to the doctors and you would say, I've got a pain in my chest. What do you recommend that we do? And it's the same for people coming to me with a project, an e-learning or a learning development project. They have an issue, and most of them will self-diagnose. They have an issue and they come and say, right, we need an e-learning course to overcome this problem. And it's my job as a consultant to sit there and say, okay, well, let's look at the facts. What is actually causing you this problem in the first place? Why? Well, let's ask the question why first. Why do you need this e-learning course? Rather than going into the details of, you know, which slides are going to be in there, what colors are we going to use, what topic are we going to use, scenarios or interactions or quizzes or, you know, videos or animations. You know, that's the what. That's the what we're going to build. But we can't think about that until we've decided why we're going to build it in the first place. So these road mapping sessions, they just let the client really dig deep into the problem. Some people call them discovery sessions. I mean, we could also call it, I mean, from a learning perspective, we could call them a needs analysis session, you know, the training needs analysis at the beginning of the project. But I think until we've done that, it's very difficult to come up with a solution. So I say that's really important for any project to have that kind of discovery, road mapping, whatever you want to call it, dig deep into the problem, identify what the problem is, and only then can we come up with a solution. And I like to provide, you know, 2 or 3 solutions if possible, to give the client some options as to different ways that we could take it. And that really can demonstrate my expertise, so because I can provide, you know, different solutions to their problems. We can take route A, which will be quicker, might be cheaper, and it might not solve the problem as completely as route B or route C. But just providing those different options will give the end clients some choices as to where they go next.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah, I like that. I like that take on it. Do you find that is sort of extra work developing these sort of 3 scenarios and that's worth it? for you? It seems like it would be.
Yeah, totally. I've had a lot of success with that because I find that, I mean, from a, if we're looking at it from a psychological point of view, from a sales perspective, I think it's great because if you're, for example, competing against other businesses who are also proposing that this client will work with them. Let's say this client's put out, there's three companies vying for the work and each company provides one proposal. They've got a choice of three proposals. Now, if you provide them three options and there's three people competing for the work and the other two competitors provide one option, the client then has five options and three of them are from you. So you've increased your chances of getting that work from, I guess, 33% up to, my math is terrible, but up to, you know, 3 out of 5. So you're massively increasing the chances of being given that work. And I mean, that sounds a bit salesy. I mean, that's from a sort of psychological point of view as a freelancer. I think that's a good idea to do that. But I think it's definitely giving the client some value as well. I mean, if you're providing a different way of solving the problem and you're proposing different ways of achieving the same solution, that's great for them to give them some option and gives the client the ability to take some control and decide which path they want to take to solve that problem.
I like that a lot. And I think a lot of people are going to want to steal that idea. So that is really useful. Thank you so much for sharing that.
No, that's cool. I stole it anyway. So it's none of the stuff I'm talking about today is my own ideas. You know, it's all stuff that I've learned through listening to podcasts and reading blogs and reading books and getting involved in these communities. And they're just ideas that have been shared with me. So, you know, it's important to pass them on, isn't it?
So, Ant, one of the reasons I invited you on the show today was another guest, Alyssa Gomez, recently took your new crash course called Unleash the Potential of E-Learning in Your Business and found a whole lot of value in it. Like, she was raving about it. So I wanted to know what sparked the idea to create that course.
I spoke to Alyssa about it a couple of weeks ago, actually, and she mentioned she'd just finished the course and she was, you know, really excited by some of the ideas in there. And it was great to hear that feedback. It's only been available for about 4 weeks. So it was, I think Alyssa was probably one of the first people to actually complete the course. So it was great to hear her feedback. But I just really wanted to share my experiences, especially I took a head of e-learning role in 2010, where I joined a company that had zero e-learning. It was a massive international company, big sort of blue chip organization that had, I think they had a team of about 10 technical trainers working at the company. And their role was to go out to the partner network and to train the partners and filter that training down through the partner network it was all training around products and services. So just to help that partner network to sell and to support the products of the company. It was going back to a telecommunications company. And when I joined the company, they didn't have any e-learning. And these trainers were flying around the world. They were, you know, clocking up thousands of air miles and spending. And not only were they doing, you know, incurring huge costs for providing that training through travel and you know, through the high cost of taking people out of their day-to-day job, but doing that face-to-face training, but they were repeating the same training over and over again because of the way that the company was set up and the partner network was literally worldwide. So these poor guys, they would be experts in, they were really, really technical. They had a lot of skills, but they were just doing very, very high level training and they were just repeating the same training over and over again. And they had so much more expertise to give. So the company really was crying out for an online learning solution where they could take this high level training and they could deliver that online. And then that would free up the technical trainers to go and do some of the hands-on training, the demonstrations, the product training, the engineering type stuff that couldn't be done online. And it would really free them up and it would save the company, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds in travel costs because they would no longer be delivering high-level training in a face-to-face environment. So I joined this company, you know, and I had a limited experience in implementing e-learning into big organizations. I had done it in one previous company and it hadn't been my main project. So, you know, I had to learn pretty quickly how to do this. And I felt very confident with the content side. So creating the courses and creating the actual modules that would sit on the platform. But I had to learn quite quickly about, you know, implementing LMSs. Well, in the first place, actually choosing an LMS. So how to go out and identify which is the best learning management system to choose for this organization. But actually implementing an LMS platform was designed primarily for partners, but it was going to be used for the employees as well. So I had two kind of subsets of audience there who I had to cater for. I had to build a team, a small team of instructional designers, LMS administrators, content developers, all in-house. We were going to build all the content internally. And what I actually learned, I learned all of those things. You know, I made a few mistakes, but that side of things went pretty well. But I think the thing that I found a challenge was to learn about how to promote the e-learning program as a whole. There wasn't much information out there that helped me with, for example, marketing the e-learning program. How do you get people to engage with the content? We create some amazing courses. We create some, you know, a fantastic resource that was available, but how did we get that information out there and keep it front of mind for people who were, you know, going to benefit from this type of information and this type of product? And that's what I really learned. And just through trial and error and through lots of reading and lots of listening to podcasts and lots of talking to other people who've done it before, I learned lots of tactics and techniques for really engaging with the audience and making that e-learning program successful. And the most important thing was providing or demonstrating a return on investment for that e-learning program that we'd introduced. And doing that was a challenge. So what I've done in the Unleash the Potential of e-learning in your business crash course is I really wanted to take as many of those techniques as I could and put them in kind of a simple to understand format that people could read. And I mean, I thought about kind of writing it into a book, putting it into an ebook or into a PDF. And I just thought, you know, that's probably not, I've got so many PDFs that I've downloaded off the internet that I've got sitting on my hard drive that I haven't read. And I thought, what another option would have been to build an e-learning course. And people have said, well, you know, why didn't you build an e-learning course? This is all about e-learning. And I thought, well, you know, that's great. But I think the way that I'm consuming most information at the moment, apart from podcasts, I'd say podcasts actually is probably the number one way that I'm consuming information. And I am actually looking to convert the crash course into kind of an audiobook type format where, you know, people can listen to it and I'll probably break it down into a number of different episodes. But yeah, I thought that delivering it via email sort of drip fed over a number of days was a great way to deliver that information because people are in their inboxes all day, every day. I'm on some fantastic email lists that just give me so much value. And every time I get an email from a variety of different people, it's just such useful information. It really, really helps me to do my job, to develop as an individual, to help me develop as a business owner. So yeah, I just figured email was a great mechanism to deliver that information. And it's just a series of, I think there's 11 emails in total. So it's not a huge amount of content. Each email takes sort of 15, 20 minutes to read. And I always recommend that people kind of save the emails sort of into a subfolder so they can set aside some time to read them when they can concentrate, you know, whether that's they're sitting on the train on the way to work or if they're on the bus or, you know, on their lunch breaks at work or sitting in front of the TV, but just somewhere that they can focus and not be distracted rather than just glancing at it as they scan through their inbox. But yeah, it's early days. It's had some good feedback so far, but I'm trying to spread the word. And if anybody's interested in signing up, it's a completely free crash course at unleashelearningpotential.com. Yeah, and you can sign up and I'm really keen to get some feedback. And there's lots of, it's a very actionable course as well. So I've tried to make it not just me telling you, you know, my experience, but more about, right, this is an example of something I think can work. And then here's some actions that you can go and take to maybe implement this. And then they're all very simple actions. It's not something that's going to take a long time. It's not going to cost any money. And they're things that you can try, you know, pretty much today to see if you can increase the amount of engagement you're getting with e-learning within your organization.
Nice. Yeah, I've been really fascinated by the sort of subscription learning that is happening via email. And yeah, I think it's a great format. And I love that you sort of set expectations there and say, hey, you know, take this, save it, and read it at a time that you can focus and concentrate on it. So all wonderful things. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm going to go sign up myself. We're going to link to it in the show notes. And I think it's something that you can learn from the content, but you can also learn from the way that you set this up. So it's going to be really useful for a lot of people.
Cool. Yeah. I expect to see your name pop up in my inbox soon, Kristen.
It will. It absolutely will. So who would you say is your intended audience for the course? Is it sort of business owners? Could, you know, instructional designers and e-learning developers learn from it? Who would you say you sort of wrote it for?
Yeah, I think I wrote it primarily for somebody who is in charge or looking after learning development at their organization. So it might be that they're sort of specialist sort of e-learning managers, or it might be that they're kind of higher level kind of learning and development managers. But, you know, there's a lot of different people who I think would benefit. Another sort of subset is kind of maybe smaller business owners who are looking to deliver training to their audience. Maybe they're currently focused, you know, they're currently focused on delivering training in a face-to-face environment. So that's their business model, where they, you know, maybe sell face-to-face training and they're looking to use their expertise and to put that into an online training kind of environment platform, if you like. And yeah, e-learning developers, people who are, you know, developing the content themselves, because I think from my experience, most corporate e-learning teams are quite small. You know, it's only very few organizations that have these, you know, huge e-learning teams internally. And a lot of it seems to be outsourced, and a lot of the time, you know, there's just a small amount of resource that is going into creating the e-learning programs. So, you know, I think generally we find that content developers will often get involved with things like, you know, the learning management system and actually getting people enrolled onto the courses. And I think a lot of times, you know, that's how success, unfortunately, I think that's often how success is measured with some of these programs, is how many people have taken the course and how many people have enrolled, which it's not really a measure of success. You know, there's no way of seeing how many people have taken the course and being able to say, well, that's given the company X hundred thousands of dollars or pounds in profit. You know, there's no way of doing that. But actually, I think a lot of key stakeholders will measure the success of an e-learning program with, I say, essentially what we would call in the classroom environment, bums on seats. You know, how many people have taken the course. So, but yeah, I think anyone who's interested in e-learning, I would hope, would really benefit and get some value out of the course. And obviously, if, you know, get halfway through and you're not enjoying it, there's a big unsubscribe button at the bottom and you can opt out and we can still be friends.
Nice. Okay. So, and you know, throughout this conversation, you have talked about sort of giving back and putting it forward. Would you say that that's sort of why you decided to do all of this work? I mean, because it's work that you did to create this course and then just put it out there for free?
Well, I mean, to be totally honest with you, it's a marketing technique. You know, it's a way for me to demonstrate my expertise. That's exactly why I'm talking to you on this podcast, as well as being passionate about your learning and being keen to speak to you. I'm lucky to really enjoy what I do as a business and the industry that I work in. I am very passionate about it. I love what I do. But of course, you know, I'm doing this to make money. I'm doing this to build a successful, sustainable business. I've just had a baby about 3.5 weeks ago, so I've now got a family to look after. And
oh, nice.
Yeah, so it's all gone a bit crazy, but I'm building a business, and I think putting my knowledge out there, I think some people say, well, hang on, you're giving away all your information there and you're giving it away for free. But actually, you know, I would like to think I know a lot more than I'm giving away. And, you know, if people can learn from the information that I'm providing, brilliant. And then hopefully that will, in their eyes, I will now be somebody who they could turn to if they had additional questions and they needed additional help. So, you know, a lot of companies won't have the resource to do some of this work internally. So they might want to learn how to do it, but they actually haven't got the ability to do it themselves. So, you know, that's where I could come in as in a kind of consulting capacity and actually help implement some of the ideas that I'm suggesting in the course. So, it's not completely selfless. I am obviously running a business and trying to make money just like everyone else. Yeah, I think, you know, I think I've mentioned a few times already, and I'm such a big fan of podcasts and reading some of these brilliant blogs that are out there and some of the resources that are out there that are free. You know, you would never need to spend any money on any audiobooks or Kindle books or physical books ever again, or university courses if you didn't want to, because there's just so much amazing information out there. And you've got to have a filter. I mean, there's a lot of rubbish as well. And you see a lot of companies pumping out content just because, you know, they want to get as many eyes on their content as they can. But actually, if you can filter through that and find the good stuff, there's so much good stuff out there, and it's all for free. And I think that's the way that content is going. It's going to be that model moving forward.
Yeah. So, I mean, I actually listen to a lot of podcasts myself. And one of my favorites, I don't know if you listen to it, but is the $100 MBA.
No, I've never listened to that.
Oh my gosh, it's a great podcast. So, but Omar Zinholm talks a lot about content marketing. And this is absolutely one of the things that he mentions, is this, yeah, you know, sometimes you give away a little bit and yeah, build an audience, build your expertise so that people learn to trust you. So that is really useful for people who are trying to start a side business, people who are freelancers, people who are solopreneurs. So all of those things Absolutely. Again, just reiterating that, you know, you can go and sign up for Ant's course and learn from the content, but also learn from what you're doing.
Yeah, definitely. I'll have to add that to my my list of podcasts. Although it's kind of bittersweet. Every time somebody gives me another podcast recommendation, I add it to my app and I'm already kind of weeks behind. I'm just kind of like, oh no, I've got even more to listen to now. But it's such good stuff. And the great thing is it's there forever, isn't it? It's not going anywhere. And you can, you know, I always try and favorite my podcasts. So if they're good, I'll favorite them and I can go back to them in the future and listen to them again. And so much good stuff out there.
All right. So last question here before I let you go. After someone completes your course, what's the next step, do you think?
Yeah, well, once they finish the course, actually, I write like a weekly email that they'll receive after that. So, you know, they carry on. The last email, I actually give them the option whether they want to carry on receiving emails from me or, you know, if they've had enough and then that's been great, they can opt out and that's the end of that. So I'm writing a lot of content at the moment. I really enjoy writing and I'm really enjoying, you know, appearing on podcasts like this, and I'm speaking at lots of conferences. So I'm really enjoying this part of building a business, the speaking and the writing and the talking and that kind of thing. And so I'm writing a lot of content. I'm keen to sort of share more. I've written this first course. I've got two more ideas for other sort of crash courses that I want to write. I'm not sure whether to put them into crash course format or whether to kind of try and maybe write an ebook or in fact an actual proper book. You know, that's something else maybe I'd like to do later down the line. But yeah, so carrying on with the emails is an option. Yeah, that's it for now. I mean, if anyone wants to reach out and speak to me, I'm available. I'm here and I'm keen to carry on conversations and work on exciting projects. That's kind of it for now.
Yeah. So very last question before we let you go. Where can people catch up with you?
Yeah, cool. So I'm pretty much on most social networks. My Twitter handle is AntPugh, so that's AntPugh. You can find the crash course is unleashelearningpotential.com. I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook. E-Learning Architect is my e-learning consultancy name, so elearningarchitect.co.uk, all one word. Yeah, you can get me on. And if you're interested in the community I mentioned earlier, I help organize that. That's called the Online Network of Independent Learning Professionals. And we have a group on LinkedIn, and you can either email myself, so I'm ant@elearningarchitect.co.uk, or you can email my colleague Patty Bryant. I haven't got an email address on me, but I will pop that in the show notes as well. But Patty's been brilliant in organizing that community, so I'll give her a shout out as well. But her company's called E-Learning Reinvented. But yeah, we'll pop her details in the show notes if that's cool, and all of the contact details.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but definitely hit me up if you want to have a chat, or if you know like me to speak on your podcast or speak at an event, I'd be more than happy to come and do that. And I'm really, really keen to carry on the conversation afterwards.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Ant, for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Kristen.
As I've mentioned previously, many, many people are creating online courses these days, and they don't look anything like the typical e-learning courses we think we should create or have been creating. Their learning experiences are finite newsletter courses or video courses using this subscription learning model. And Ant in this episode gave us some great insight into how he's taking advantage of that to better market himself and his business. I think that you can take advantage of that as well, not only to market yourself or your business, but even as an ID or e-learning developer within an organization. I think that we should all consider this subscription learning model as an alternative product type that we can create. Bite-sized chunks of varied media types, interactions, text, yes, text still works, images and video, each with actionable follow-ups. I would love to continue the conversation over this. You can find Ant on Twitter. He's @AntPugh, that's AntPugh. And his website is elearningarchitect.co.uk. And as always, you can reach out to me. I'm @AntChris, or you can shoot me an email at kristen@dearinstructionaldesigner.com. Thank you so much for listening, and take care.